This episode of the Pillar Podcast is brought to you by Seton Home Study School. For more information, go to setonhome.org.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Pillar Podcast, the podcast that brings you eclipsing Catholic conversation each week. I'm your host and Pillar Editor-in-Chief, J.D. Flynn, and I'm joined by my podcasting partner, Ed, the dark spot over the sun, Condon himself. Ed, there's an eclipse on Monday. Are you? Have you ever seen a total eclipse of the sun?
No. I'm familiar with a total eclipse of the heart, but I have never seen a total eclipse.
Yeah, turn around, bright eyes. That's what I should have said. I should have said, Ed, bright eyes, Condon.
You could have, but the moment has passed. Like an eclipse, here and gone.
I have seen a total eclipse of the sun. I saw one in 2017 when the path of totality, so to speak, was right over my house.
Oh, that's nice.
And it was awesome. It was awesome. It was cool.
It was very dark.
It gets dark. Yeah. It does. It's very, very cool. You can see, if you see a total eclipse, you can understand why the ancients worshipped the sun.
I've always imagined that the thing you want to do with a total eclipse is find a group of people who don't know what it is and proclaim yourself their king. Like that's the function of it.
That's the ideal.
Like, I mean, you want to do a King Solomon's Mines thing and just basically say, aha. But, you know, you need a good watch.
That's right.
You know, they make watches, I think, that that will predict eclipses for you.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. They're good stuff.
The Eclipse-O-Matic.
Yeah.
And I don't know about you. We took off the Triduum and we're back now. I don't know about you, but I am exhausted. We are recording this on Friday afternoon. This feels like the end of a very, very long week for me. Does it feel like that for you?
Yes and no. I have a lot that I have to do this weekend. I have a number of things to do around the house and also things, that I have to do outside of the house that I probably don't have time for. So I'm actually kind of looking at the weekend as it's going to be even busier than this week has been. And then I'm getting on a plane on Monday, which is why I will not see the eclipse. Or still don't imagine. Can you see the eclipse from the air? Is that a thing?
Well, let me tell you what I have just learned. Delta Airlines,
the worst airline in the world,
in my experience, yes, is offering a flight on Monday. I presume it's already sold out, which will take off from Austin, Texas, and land in Detroit on Monday, specifically so that Umbrophiles, those are
shadow people.
Yes, those are shadow people. Yes, that's exactly what they are, shadow lovers. So that vampires and other shadow lovers. We'll be able to spend as much time as possible directly within the path of totality. So Delta Flight 1218 will be specifically operated on an A22-300, which will offer especially premium viewing due to the aircraft's extra large windows. This is that plane that has extra large windows. It'll take off from Austin at 1215 CT and land in Detroit at 420 ET. Time to give those on board the best chance of safely viewing the solar eclipse at its peak.
Except it will actually take off at 3 p.m., be diverted to San Diego, and lose your bags.
No, there's no way. There's no way.
It's Delta. They'll find a way.
Ed, how much do you think it would cost to take the Delta flight of totality? How much do you think the ticket would be?
It's one way. This is a one-way ticket.
It's
so you're stuck
way.
In
it's
Detroit.
It's a flight from Austin to Detroit. Well, then you just get another flight from Detroit, but yeah.
How many people on the plane?
Couple hundred.
I'm going to say $1,000, JD. Nice round number.
That main cabin prices start at $749, but I think it is possible that start means sitting in an aisle seat. The only time you wouldn't want an aisle seat.
Right.
Well, a first class
seat. You can sit in the middle of the plane away from the window.
Well, a first class seat costs $1,150. So it's a little bit more than a flight, but it's not like tens of thousands. Now, here's what I'd like to do. I'd like to be the guy who buys himself a window seat, sits down on the plane, puts his pillow on the wall / window, goes to sleep, just to sort of see the reaction of everybody else.
I think that's fair. And just say, what? I've got a meeting in Detroit.
I got a meeting in Detroit. That's right.
You would be ill-advised, I think, to fall asleep or try that maneuver on a plane with people who are paying over the odds to see a shadow.
You think they'd be angry with you?
I think they're unstable people.
I hope that we have a listener, an Umbrophile listener, who will be on the flight. If you're an Umbrophile listener on the flight, I don't think you're an unstable person. I would just love to get their account of all things.
Yes, Umbridge. I'd like to know how late your takeoff is, where they actually send the plane, what mechanical failures actually prevent takeoff from happening, and above all, how Delta aren't going to refund you a single penny.
Well, we have to make a transition because we did plan to have banter at the beginning of this show, but this is not the banter that we planned to have. We planned to have different banter. So we have to.
We did?
Ed, as you know, you have been doing yoga for the past couple of months. And about 5 weeks ago, I took up, this is not related, it was just a transition. But about 5 weeks ago, I did something that I have been meaning to do for a little while, but had put off. And I started lifting weights.
You started lifting heavy things.
Yeah, started getting in the practice of lifting heavy weights. They're not really that heavy yet because I'm just getting started, but I started a weightlifting regimen. And I have really enjoyed it. I have found in even just these 5 weeks that I can lift heavier things than I could when I began, and that it's great. There's a great deal of satisfaction in lifting heavy things, and my muscles are sore like basically all the time, but it's the kind of good sore that means
you've been doing work. I'm familiar with the sort of Protestant righteous feeling of justification through labor and effort.
Right.
Yeah.
And one of the things that came out of that is that I was invited to join a DM group, a sort of group text on Twitter of lifters, many of whom are of sort of Catholic lifters, many of whom are priests, diocesan priests or religious priests, I suppose, who lift weights. And in the course of this DM group, they talk about their experiences and ask questions of each other and give each other encouragement and feedback and these kinds of things. And it's all very, very nice. And I was very grateful to be invited to be a part of it. But in the course of that conversation, just a couple of days ago, someone told us about a product called Keto Bricks. A keto brick, Ed, is a 1,000 calorie bar, 1,000 calorie brick food, which is hard and dense, calorie dense, nutrient dense, and surprisingly fatty, that is meant to be a meal supplement for a person who's doing, you know, the keto diet. Mm-hmm. But the keto brick, which is how it's actually marketed, what it's actually called, seems to me to be effectively the closest a civilian can come to Nutriloaf. Do you know what Nutriloaf is?
No.
Nutriloaf is a punishment food that's served in American prisons. So
it's not sufficient that you're already in prison?
If you're in segregated housing, like if you're in if you're ordered to isolation, or if you are otherwise misbehaving in prisons.
Oh, if you're in the SHU.
If you're in the SHU, as it were. In some states, it is still legal to serve prisoners something called Nutriloaf, which is basically a very dense brick-like amalgamation of various kinds of foods, which are
Soylent Green, basically.
Together. It's Soylent Green, but not people. There's not nearly that much protein in
that's it. That's not proven, but okay.
Yeah. Okay. So this thing, this keto brick, is, it seems to me, probably the closest that civilians can come to ordinary Nutriloaf. It's a big, dense brick that's probably not very tasty. And these guys were asking me as a journalist if I would consider eating these bricks and then reviewing them, telling them about the experience of eating them and what they did on my, what they did to my digestive system and what they tasted like and these sort of things. And Ed, I was reluctant, but we struck a deal, these guys and I. And the deal is this. I told them that I would be happy as a journalist to not only taste these keto bricks, but to consume them as my sole source of caloric input, my only food, for a number of days, if they could generate for us, in exchange for this work, some subscribers or upgraders to the Pillar. I told them that for every 25 paying subscribers they could get to the Pillar, I would spend one day in which all of my calories came from keto bricks. And that they could get me for as many as a week if they wanted to, if they could generate enough subscriptions or paid upgrades to the Pillar from Keto Bricks. Why? Because we have some goals. We're very close to some goals that will allow us to like significantly expand our reporting capacity at the Pillar. We're very excited about this stuff, but we need some more subscribers in order to do the things that we want to do to serve the church. And I am willing to sort of take one for the team and subsist solely on Keto Bricks and then review the whole experience in the Pillar post in exchange for some more subscribers or people to upgrade their subscription. Yay.
I think this is a calculated gamble. You're basically playing the spread here because the success of this ploy so far, in the last day or two, as far as I can tell, has been minimal.
They, Ed, though, are on the cusp of 2 days. Mm. They are very, very close to having earned enough subscribers or upgrades for me to need to eat these bricks for 2 days. And now I kind of want to see if they can get to 3 or 4 because I'd like to see what it's like. And so the reason we're telling this very long story now, it feels a bit like a Norm MacDonald Shaggy Dog, I guess, but there's no punchline. But the reason we're telling this story now is that if you have been considering subscribing to The Pillar, or if you have been considering upgrading your subscription to The Pillar, there will be links for both in the show notes. Now would be a great time to do it, because if you subscribe or upgrade and then just send me a note by email or DM or whatever, and let me know that you have, or comments, the comments in this on the on our website or whatever, you'll count towards the number of subscriber days that they're going to earn for me to eat these things.
I think it's a very weird move on your part, but I kind of want to see where it goes. So
you think it's a weird move, but you have offered yourself in this.
I think I said 150 just as a, that they are not going to generate 150
new subscribers. You told them that if they get 150 new subscribers, you will do it with me for a week.
No, I didn't say for a week. I did not say that. That is not what I said. I did not say that. In fact, I said it is very clearly the medical opinion that if you try to eat these things for a week, you will hurt yourself. I said maybe.
Oh, yeah. It's probably not advisable. 2 or 3 days at the most. But I am willing to do it out of love for The Pillar, and you're willing to do in a, you know, an iteration of it out of love for The Pillar if we get enough subscribers or upgrades. So if you want us to eat these bricks and document it, as these guys are very excited and they've now generated a fair amount of subs about it, if you want us to eat these bricks and document it, upgrade your subscription or become a paying subscriber and let me or Ed know about it, and you'll be counted among the Operation Keto Brick.
I'm rooting for them. I would like to see you hurt yourself with BS dietary supplements. I think that would be amusing. I question how much of the heavy things you'll be lifting for a few days after you undertake.
Oh, no, I think it's probably good. You don't think it's probably good for that? I mean, it has the word keto in it.
I think so, if you're no, I think if your intestinal system seizes up, it becomes uncomfortable.
Is that what you think is going to happen?
Yes.
Do you think this was ill advice on my part?
I think it was incredibly foolish of you, but you know, that's fine. I'm not saying I wouldn't attempt to, I wouldn't do it with food, but I, you know, the Lord knows there, but for the grace of God go I, is all I'm saying. And good luck to you.
Okay. So, Ed, we have been talking now for a little while. I'm not sure exactly how long, but we're going to take a break from banter to talk about some church stuff, because we're recording this podcast on Friday, and on Monday, the Dicastery for the Doctrine of the Faith is set to release a Declaration on Human Dignity. What's very interesting about this Declaration on Human Dignity, whose title will be Dignitas Infinita. This, first of all, this is a very strange title, if you ask me. But anyway, Cardinal, I do. As in Chippets go, putting infinitas in it makes me feel like I'm buying a car or some kind of a mirrored fountain for my backyard or an infinity pool or something like that. It's just infinite dignity, as I suppose a very nice concept, indeed a very nice concept. But the incipit dignitas infinitas just makes me laugh every time.
Well, okay. All right.
It sounds like.
You don't care for it. I understand.
I don't care for it. No, I don't care for it. But the DDF will be issuing a declaration, which is a kind of, I don't know. I suppose, what is a declaration?
I mean, it is, I would call it a sort of statement of theological fact, according to the mind of the church. I think it is a declaration. It's a declarative statement. This is how it is. It's not nothing. This is not an advisory opinion. It's not a, you know, infallible teaching. But, you know, it doesn't necessarily treat a credendo or tenenda, you know, level teaching. But it is a declaration. It is an imperative document. It's a statement of fact. This is what it be.
And some of them have been very short. So
yes.
A declaration is a document of the CDF, the DDF, and some of them have been very short. So for example, the Declaration on Masonic Associations of 1983, which we've talked about before,
yes,
basically is four paragraphs that say, still can't be a Mason.
Yeah.
Right?
I mean, I have my own views on that particular declaration.
I know. I was just using it as an example. I wasn't trying to bait you there.
Oh, okay. We can unpack about what I like and don't like about that declaration.
I think we have done a lot of Mason. I think we've done a lot of
people love.
I think we've done a lot of Mason stuff lately. But Fiducia Supplicans was a declaration.
I think the declaration that came before fiducia supplicans and said that the church has to be very careful about anything which gives the appearance of marriage, that a same-sex relationship is corresponding to marriage was a declaration. So there have been, so a declaration is effectively a document of the CDF, not like an encyclical or something like that of the pontiff, but something of the CDF, which is meant to offer some affirmation of theological reality.
Yeah.
And this one is meant to be, according to Cardinal Fernandez, the prefect of the DDF, is meant to be a kind of declaration on what he says, human dignity, but he says that gender, that it will discuss, among other things, gender ideology. What else? Do you recall what else it's supposed to talk about?
I think he's made a big thing about surrogacy being in there.
Yeah, that's going to address.
He's repeatedly trailed that. I mean, the interesting thing about this is we've been waiting for a declaration or some sort of teaching document from the DDF on these issues for quite some years now. We've reported in the past, because we got a hold of the copy, that they've had a copy of a version of this sitting in a drawer in the offices of the DDF since 2018, I think. And, you know, they never got around to putting it out there for one reason or another. And now something treating that it is going to come out. So we've been waiting for this for a very long time. On the other hand, Cardinal Fernandez seems to have only mentioned this as near as I can tell, you know, because he's been trialing this, sort of saying, this is coming. We're working on this. We're almost done with this. This is coming out soon. It's going to happen. He seems to only have ever mentioned it that I'm aware of, at least certainly in recent months, within the context of people being mad at him for fiducia supplicans.
Yeah, basically. And then he says,
okay, you didn't like my last record, but you're going to love my new single. It's going to be, you know, I promise. It's going
to. If you love the OG stuff from the CDF or the Holy Office or the Inquisition, whatever you prefer, we're going back to our roots on this last one. Yeah, that was fiducia supplicans was a bit of an experimental album, but we're going back to the hits here. And you're going to be very happy about it, unless you liked fiducia supplicans too much, in which case you ain't going to like this one at all. That does seem to be the tenor of the thing. Hey, conservatives, we got something for you.
Yeah, or at least we are capable of putting out documents that don't annoy half the church.
Yeah. And so, I mean, the first thing that's to be said is it will be interesting to see whether that's true.
Yes.
I will not be surprised if there are some elements of the document which – look, no one will be surprised if there are elements of the document which generate controversy in the manner of Pope Francis' documents, in which some doctrinal truth that is meant to be reaffirmed or represented in a new way or presented with novelty for novelty's sake causes controversy because of the exact phrasing or something like that. I mean, in other words, if the thing is a little bit, you know, if there's a great deal of brouhaha over sort of a very few small number of words, I don't think too many people will be surprised.
I think no one will be surprised. You know, some of the most controversial documents of the last, 10 years in the church have, you know, really focused on one sentence or one paragraph or one footnote. This has been the pattern that we've observed, that, you know, these things can often have a single controversial note in them that everyone gets very excited about. I don't know what to expect from this one particularly. We are to a certain extent speculating and guessing here because I haven't
wholly
seen
and it. Entirely speculating and guessing.
One of the questions I am looking forward to having answered when the document drops, we assume on Monday because there's a press conference scheduled for its presentation then, is why this document? For many years now, people have been asking for some sort of Vatican document teaching on issues around gender ideology, surrogacy, things like that. And we haven't had a sort of big one from the DDF, but we have had documents from other dicasteries talking about these issues at some length, in fact, giving them quite systematic treatment. Pope Francis has spoken extremely clearly and forthrightly on these issues numerous times. So I guess I'm curious, and I assume the document will answer this either explicitly or it will be obviously inferable from the text itself. Why now? Why this? What is this for? Who is it answering? You know, if this is a declaration of what it be, where's the ambiguity that it is seeking to address?
Yeah, because there's also the document, which is a text of the Holy See, Do you remember the 2019 document, Male and Female, he created them from the Congregation for Catholic Education?
I do.
Which was a very, which had some practical considerations for Catholic schools and universities related to sort of dealing with questions of transgenderism and those kinds of things. But before that, proceeded with a long kind of excursus on gender ideology, gender identity, and the Catholic position on it as a document effectively identified itself.
And since this is important to some people these days, not just what the church teaches about this, but what Pope Francis personally has said about this, since, you know, right. We live in the era where there's a section of the church who seem fixated with, you know, the personal magisterium of Pope Francis as somehow being its own thing that, you know, it's not part and parcel of the magisterium of the church for some reason. But both of those things, yeah. Sorry, carry on. I interrupted you.
No. I mean, just precisely what I was going to say. So your question about sort of who is this for is a good question. My best hope, like my biggest hope, and, you know, we'll see if it's right or not, but my biggest hope would be that the purpose of this document is to sort of actually, much like the text that came out from the CDF last year that responded to some questions about godparents and transgender identity and baptism mm-hmm. and transgender identity, it actually responded to practical questions which are raised in the life of the church such that the diocesan bishop would have some guidance from the Holy See regarding how to answer new emerging and controversial questions. In the best possible world, Dignitas Infinitas would be a reiteration of those things which are expressed in male and female.
Sorry, I don't want to be pedantic, but is it Dignitas Infinitas or is it Dignitas Infinita?
In as much as I know, it's Dignitas Infinitas, which should we parse that?
I'm going to look it up. I'm going to look that up.
We have it listed as Dignitas Infinita. Basically, it looks to me like some Catholic media outlets are using Dignitas Infinitas, but Dignitas Infinita is correct, first of all, grammatically, and second of all, more commonly used. So yeah, I was saying Dignitas Infinitas drawing from some Catholic media sources that I was reading, but that is incorrect, and any Catholic media source that was using it was incorrect to use it, both grammatically and then the actual reported name of the incipit.
Okay.
Thank you for correcting that. I have now lost my page, so you're going to have to tell me what I said.
I apologize for making you lose your thread.
No, I'm very grateful.
Not my.
I do not want to sound stupid.
No, we have many classical scholars.
Infinitas is wrong, and I don't want to use the wrong word.
And it sounded wrong, and that's why I wanted to just double.
It sounded wrong to me even as I was using it, but I read it in a.
Did you read it on the pillar?
No, I didn't, and that was my mistake. Actually, this is not meant to be a commercial. This is not meant to be a commercial, but I read it somewhere else right before we started this show, and that was a huge, huge mistake on my part.
Yeah. Only trust the pillar.
I'm just saying.
I don't believe it until I've written it.
In this case, not trusting the pillar didn't work out for me, or not reading it in the pillar didn't work out for me. Okay, so what I think I might have been saying was that in the best case scenario, it'd be great if Dignitas Infinita was a reiteration of the theological sort of the theological anthropology outlined in Male and Female, He Created Them, which is a very strong and very clear document of 2019 from the Congregation for Catholic Education, followed by, again, some more reflection on sort of pastoral care and pastoral issues drawn from what sacred revelation, you know, what sacred revelation says, and then what the church has taught and how she's reflected on these kinds of things and all that. In the worst case scenario, Dignitas Infinitas will be an attempt to rearticulate Catholic teaching in a way that doesn't offend anyone. I mean, there's no other way to put it. In the worst case scenario, Dignitas Infinitas will be an attempt to sort of Infinita. Did I do it again?
Yes.
Confound it. Dignitas Infinita will be, in the worst case scenario, what was I saying?
Will be some attempt to repact. I'm just going to sit in the corner for a minute. And just say Dignitas Infinita over and over again until it sticks. And
Tell them what I was going to say and then you respond to it.
Okay. No, what you were saying is the worst case scenario is Dignitas Infinita could be an attempt to sort of either sanitize or repackage the church's teaching in a way that doesn't upset the New York Times editorial board. Or makes people
quite right.
Yeah, makes people feel generally warm and fluffy.
With the idea that will, so to speak, build a bridge. But my expectation is that that won't build a bridge at all. That if that's the case, then we'll have a great deal of controversy about all of this, because there'll be lots of people who raise objection to what the DDF has said. And there will be several rounds of the sort of Pope Francis document internecine wars.
Well, so that'll be interesting to see. A couple of points I would make at this juncture. The first is this: as you mentioned, the practical application of the church's teaching on these issues in schools, in sort of sacramental practice at the parochial level, these have all been answered already in different documents and answered fairly recently.
I mean, there is disagreement. There's considerable disagreement in terms of among policies with regard to how do they approach these things. But I think the CD or I think the Holy See has said as much as she's going to say.
Yeah, they're not going to get any more granular with the guidance of who can do what, when, and under what conditions than they already have.
Far be it from the Holy See to sort of regulate what you can print in a bulletin or something like that. That's just not how good leadership happens in the life of the church.
Yeah, no, well, quite. Well, then that's easier, because then you know that's what Twitter's for, is to police all of the parish bulletins.
Right, exactly.
You have to have a vast electronic surveillance network to be able to bring that to life, to animate it sufficiently. But anyway, okay. So if the practical aspects have already been addressed, it seems to me the only likely function of a document like this on this subject at this time is to offer, as you say, some sort of synthesis, some sort of new presentation, some sort of way of speaking about these issues as a coherent whole, which can help the church at every level, from bishops down to the lay faithful, engage with these subjects, which are very prevalent in some parts of the world, not in others, it should be noted. In fact, not in lots of other parts of the world are these issues at all prevalent. I wonder how New York Times editorial board friendly, for lack of a better word, this language can get, though, because this is not so when Cardinal Fernandez was announced as the incoming DDF prefect, before he even got to Rome, he was saying things like, well, I want to look again to get at the previous CDF declaration on, the church cannot bless sin, blessing of same-sex unions is totally impossible. And I don't actually know if that was a declaration, now that we're saying it out loud and thinking about it. I think it was a response ad dubia to the German bishops.
Yeah, it was. It was.
It was a declaration, or was a response ad dubia?
No, it was a response. Okay. I mean, the question always was, and many people raised this, is whether or not it was a legitimate response, or whether or not questions had been generated for the sake of framing something that wanted to be said as a response.
Maybe, but I want to talk about that as well in a second. But anyway, this is not like that, where when Fernandez was sort of still incoming as the nominated but not yet in office at work prefect, he said, I want to look again at that, because I don't think that it's very Pope Francis, the language. I don't think its presentation of things was, in line with the Pope's magisterium, because Cardinal Fernandez does seem to be one of those people who thinks there's such a thing as the personal magisterium of Pope Francis. And so then we got Fiducia Supplicans. Pope Francis has been pretty unambiguous about where he is on issues like surrogacy and gender ideology. He called it, I mean, I'm paraphrasing, but only in terms of language, not in terms of strength of phrase. He called it basically the worst thing in the world last month.
Yeah.
This is not an issue in which Pope Francis has been either softly spoken or even slightly ambiguous. Right. So I don't know that there's an appetite at the level of the Pope, or the quote-unquote personal magisterium of Pope Francis, for some sort of wholesale revisiting or repackaging of these issues. So that's kind of strange to me. I think an interesting litmus test will be how this is the funny thing. This has been the case long before Cardinal Fernandez took office. This is not a feature of the DDF under Cardinal Fernandez. This is just a way in which the DDF's documents have been treated and received for some time now, which is, you can tell the sort of final litmus test for, was this a document that is quote unquote conservative or quote unquote progressive, is who disowns it on behalf of Pope Francis first.
Right.
Because that's inevitably what happens, is the document comes out, somebody is upset, and somebody says, well, this isn't actually a Pope Francis document. Pope Francis needs to step in and correct this. They did this to Ladaria all the time when he was the prefect. And they did it to an extent with Fiducia Supplicans when that came out you know, people said, well, you know, this is a declaration from the DDF. This is Fernandez's mess. Pope Francis didn't, you know.
Right.
And the truth is that all of these things can be, in a sense, you know, have plausible papal deniability in a sense, because they don't, you know, Pope Francis isn't signing them. They're not papal apostolic exhortations or encyclical letters or, you know, expressions of direct papal magisterial authority, although they are under the penumbra of the Roman Curia and the, you know, they're part of the papal teaching office in that sense. But on the other hand, they, all of them, whether they are declarations or responsa dubiorum, they all have carried these little, you know, these little notes at the bottom that tell you, you know, how and why this thing came to be published. And they've all said, you know, published with the express, under the express wishes of Pope Francis, although they tend to lack the specific legal language is ordered published in forma specifica by the Holy Father, right, which means that he carries the document to himself and says, no, I am converting. This is no longer an instrument of the DDF. This is now mine. Mm-hmm. And it should be read with the full force of my authority behind it. None of them say that, but they all say Pope Francis approved this message effectively. So it will be very interesting to see who's the first team to say, well, this isn't actually a Pope Francis document, because whoever says that first will be the ones who are aggrieved by it. And I don't know. I couldn't begin to guess who will be aggrieved. I mean, someone will be. They always are.
Yeah, that's
but
right.
I don't know. I don't know who it will be or what their beef will be when all this comes out. But I suppose we'll find out on Monday.
Yeah, I think we will. I think that's a very, very good summary. I want to talk a little bit about our disposition, our Catholic disposition of receptivity to documents from the CDF or from the Holy See, and how maybe that's changed during the Francis papacy, and whether we need to reflect on that. But I want to do that after the break, because we've got a commercial coming up. Ed, this week's episode of the Pillar Podcast is brought to us by our friends at Seton Home Study School. That's setonhome.org. And Seton Home Study School, as you know, and listeners, as you probably know or may know, is an apostolate, is a project which makes educating your children at home easy, attainable, and doable. If you're a family who is sort of thinking about homeschool and you're unsure, or feel like you wouldn't be sure how to get develop the curriculum or where the curriculum should come from, Seton Home Study School is an actual school into which students can be enrolled while being educated at home, which employs teachers and other learning specialists who can help you, the parents, as the primary educators, using the Seton Home Study School curriculum to give your children a great education.
That is right. Seton Home Study are a homeschooling program that is used by many people that I know and love. I have friends, I have family who use Seton Home Study in their homes for their children. I know Catholic school teachers who teach in Catholic schools who choose to homeschool their children and use Seton books and curricula. That's the level of endorsement I see from parents, from educators in my own personal social circle. And it is delightful to have them back with the show. And one of the things that I know that they take great pride in is their English program and, you know, strong reading and writing skills with an emphasis on that, both the, you know, the grade school level and the high school level. And of course, having a good literature program is central to learning how to write well. I think you will agree.
We reviewed the curriculum, the literature curriculum of Seton Home Study School's high school curriculum. They sent it to us, and there are some really, really good and really interesting books on here. There's a pretty healthy dose of Shakespeare. There are classics like Bridge Over the San Luis Rey. There is the T.S. Eliot's verse play about the assassination of Archbishop Thomas Becket. Have you ever read or seen Murder in the Cathedral, Ed, the T.S. Eliot?
I have not, actually.
It's awesome.
I have been to Canterbury Cathedral on a number of occasions. I have been to the spot of venerated where Thomas Becket was murdered. I have not read that,
though. Well, I've never been to any of those places, but I do think Murder in the Cathedral is a cool read and a cool show. And that's part of the show, by show I mean play, a cool play. And that's part of the literature curriculum of high school for the Seton Home Study School, along with a lot of great stuff. What else stood out to you on there?
Well, there is a selection of books. What's interesting to me is you have, as you say, sort of great plays, the Shakespeare stuff, things like that. You have also what I would consider to be fun literature. You know, not everything has to be super heavy. There's the curriculum that's sent over. I was personally very edified because I suffered in my high school years. I suffered having to read a lot of Tom Hardy, who is one of the worst writers in the English language. And there was no Tom Hardy on the list I was sent by Seton, and that edified me greatly. There was, however, stuff that's just fun to read. Like The Hound of the Baskervilles is on there. Like, mm-hmm. I mean, full disclosure.
Jane Eyre.
Yeah.
Robinson Crusoe. Good stuff that's like.
Good stuff. But also you can discern it. I mean, there's Animal Farm, which, you know, should always and have always been required reading for absolutely everyone everywhere at all times, I think. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you want things like that on there. But also you can detect the influence of a sound Catholic mind guiding these things, like Tale of Two Cities, The Scarlet Pimpernel, to basically teach you that the French Revolution was bad. You know, that's an important lesson that I think should be carried well into any good high school education. You know, you mentioned Hound of the Baskervilles. Arthur Conan Doyle is just good fun to read. And I think that is the challenge of any good high school reading curriculum, is you don't want to just sort of force feed like a foie gras goose students stuff that, you know, is worthy. You want to give them stuff that's fun, that's engaging, that, you know, you want to read that stuff.
Yeah, there is a lot about this literature curriculum which we were sent, which is praiseworthy and to be commended. And that's why colleges like Ave Maria, CUA, Christendom, Steubenville, Thomas Aquinas College, and a friend of the show, University of Dallas, partner with Seton because they know that the Seton Home Study School graduates are receiving an excellent Catholic education, especially in terms of their formation of literature and good writing. So Seton Home Study School is a great friend of the show, and you should check them out at setonhome.org. That's setonhome.org. This week's episode brought to us by our friends at Seton Home Study School. Hey, everybody, we are back. And Ed, I have just been thinking, you know, this is what I want to kind of talk about. Everyone I've spoken with, I mean, honestly, I've talked with a lot of people about the coming promulgation of Dignitas Infinita. And many people, when they begin to discuss it, begin to just, you know, have in their voice an edge, or you can tell, exhibit a certain kind of trepidation. And the reason is because they are anticipating the back and forth that tends to happen with the promulgation of Francis documents. They're anticipating the kind of controversy which was seen with fiducia supplicans, the kind of controversy which was seen with the Mors Letitia, the kind of controversy which was seen fairly or unfairly with Laudato Si. They're anticipating that there will be this cycle that Francis documents often, that major Francis documents tend to have, which is that they're lauded by, as you say, the secular media, then they're panned or criticized by either a certain cadre of bishops or a broad coalition of theologians, or in some cases kind of conservative media. There's like this backlash to the documents and pushback in the documents. There's controversy about that. Then there are sort of competing interpretations of what the document is saying or not saying, and sometimes bishops' conferences get involved in that. And then at the conclusion of that, the document, like many ecclesiastical documents, goes on the shelf, not to be discussed again. There is just this sort of cycle of reception, which we have seen with a lot of Francis documents, that I think, in my experience of talking with people, they're just, people are weary of that. And
yeah, it is a little exhausting.
And in some ways, perhaps now it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, because we start even before the document comes out. Look, I mean, the promo for this document was not that great. It felt to me like what Cardinal Fernandez was doing was kind of like doing the promos for a wrestling shoot. Like, Monday, come on down. If you didn't like fiducia supplicans, we're going to give it a suplex now with this amazing Dignitas Infinita. Bam, bam. Like, just like this promo that was playing to the controversy over things, or playing into the controversy over fiducia supplicans in a way that said, like, well, we can get you back on this one. And on the one hand, people are tired of this cycle, because this cycle, which has, I think, been a relatively common occurrence during the Francis papacy, is tiring. On the other hand, there's a degree to which that cycle is now media driven, and there's a sort of backlash of resistance to Francis documents before they even come out, right? There's just like this, you know, you don't have to look very far to find a bunch of people who are already willing to say that Dignitas Infinita is heretical and, you know, defies the teachings of the church and those kinds of things. And whether you like me and you're like me and you don't love the incipit or not, like, you know, there's, you can find much more of sort of people who are willing to perpetuate a sort of theoculture war over this thing before it's promulgated. And what I've just been sort of trying to figure out is, like, what is the, one does not have to value every every word which utters forth from the mouth of Rome with the same degree of veneration or the same degree of respect or admiration. But one, I think, does have to, as a son of the church, have a kind of openness and receptivity to receiving from the church, at the same time aware of the fact that something like this declaration is not an infallible pronouncement, does require...
No, but it does require the religious submission of intellect and will.
Yeah, which is exactly what I was going to say. It does require the religious submission of intellect and will, which, as I like to think of it, means a filial docility towards receiving the thing as a son of the church. How have you, Ed, counteracted, or I just love to talk about how to better counteract the sort of reflexive aversion to the Francis document cycle?
Well,
perhaps you don't feel like you're able to.
No, but I do. You're not going to like my answer. You're going to think I'm being glib, and you often chide me for being glib. But the problem is sometimes that's just who I am. I'm not trying to be a smart ass. It's, you know, it's just the true answer to the question you've posed. How do I avoid? Well, for one thing, I don't read silly hot takes on documents that haven't come out yet. Yeah. So that's why it hadn't occurred to me to call it Dignitas Infinitas. you know, if something is obviously uninformed and opinionated and not based on fact, which it can't be because the document isn't out yet, don't read it, because that's not news. That's infotainment. Mm-hmm. And you know, that is basically the Catholic media version of cable news. You know, it's just talking heads bloviating and, you know, slapping their chests and saying, I know what's coming and I'm going to, you know, like you said, it's wrestling promo stuff. And it doesn't interest me. I mean, we did the best thing we could do was a look ahead for this, which is we just looked at the 2018 document from the DDF we had. You know, what does that say? What does male and female he created them say from the Dicastery for Catholic Education that came out in, as you said, 2019. We looked at the DDF's previous answers in the last year on some of these issues and said, okay, so here's what that say, and try and build a reasonably coherent body from which this document is likely to draw, rather than say, well, obviously he's going to, you know, write this or what, you know, whatever else nonsense is. So tuning out nonsense, I think, is a big helpful part. And part of, you know, I mentioned how we tried to cover it, but that actually is good for me, is remembering that we can have the idea, I think, wrongly, that every word that cometh from the mouth of Rome is contentious, badly written, synodal jargon with nothing to offer and nothing to say. And that's just not true. You know, a lot of the stuff that is coming out of the Roman dicasteries, including the DDF, on a sort of regular basis, that doesn't get the sort of big fanfare, you know, let's get ready to rumble fight promo before it's launched. I mean, a lot of stuff is good. It is edifying. It is intelligent. It is helpful. It is rooted in the church's magisterium. It is, you know, well-sourced. It is, you know, it's helpful. I was answering a questionnaire last night on for the school that my daughter attends. They sent the parents a questionnaire on sort of, you know, plans and priorities and what we think and whatever else. And it was multi-choice, which I resented. I don't like being boxed in that way. But I found for one of the questions the answers that were allowed me unsatisfactory. And so I wanted to, you know, and I couldn't figure out what it was I wanted to say and how I wanted to take it. So I went to the Dicastery for Catholic Education's thing on the nature and spirit of Catholic schools and Catholic education that they put out. Was it last year or the year before? I forget. I think it was 2022. But I pulled it up on my phone. I started reading. I was like, this is just a good document.
Yeah.
This is just high quality stuff. It's well sourced in both, you know, stuff that Pope Francis has said and written, in stuff JP2 said and wrote, in the Second Vatican Council, and, you know, in church teaching from before that. You know, and it's just good. It's good to read good stuff from the church. And I think that helps guard against the sort of cynical reflex of, oh, this is just going to, you know, here we go again. We're going to get locked into the, as you say, the sort of Punch and Judy routine when this comes out. And I'm sure there will be some of that. I don't know what it says. Maybe it will rightly provoke that response. I don't know. This could be another Fiducia Supplicans that, you know, gets entire, you know, pluralities of the bishops' conference up in arms. The bishops, the College of Bishops up in arms. I don't know. Maybe it will.
Yeah, and sees sort of revocations and all of this. Yeah.
Who knows? But it may equally just be a perfectly sensible, sane, well-researched, well-sourced document explaining church teaching on a sensitive, complicated, often very emotive subject. And I hope it will be the latter, but I don't know yet. But I think, you know, as you say, back to your original question, which is what's a good way to sort of tune out the noise and avoid giving into cynicism and all this, is just to remind yourself that it's not inevitable. And it's not always the case that this is how it plays out. I mean, it's kind
yeah,
of,
I think that's right.
What's irritating is the really good stuff that comes out because it's not contentious, because it doesn't come with a giant fight. It tends to be overlooked.
Yeah.
It tends to not get read, which is extremely frustrating.
You've heard listened to me now talk on and on for more than 3 years about the pastoral conversion in the life of the parish, which I think is the best thing to come out of Rome in the past 5 years.
You do
and
love
I keep
that,
talking
yes.
about it. And nobody talks about it at all because it wasn't that contentious, because it didn't say, we should do gay marriages, or we should have, you know, we should make sure you go over to bless the homes of dogs and people who are cohabiting or something like that. You know what I mean? I don't know what could be in there, but my point is, because it didn't say anything weird like that, it got very little attention whatsoever from anyone. And it's the sort of thing that I think, much like the Congregation for Catholic Education document you're talking about, that really merit honest to God, like study groups and conversations among pastors and curial officials and people like that. Not that any of those people have any time, but that there's actually good stuff there that is sort of drawn from reflection on the situation, the state of the church today, right now. I was reading today, I'm making my way through a book. It's a book of scholarly articles on penal procedure, certain elements of penal procedure in light of the new book 6. And I was reading an article about the sort of use of the special faculties to cases for certain kinds of delictual offenses. And it was an article that had been written by an undersecretary of the Congregation for Clergy. And it was like really good guidance on a very practical subject, but that was rooted in the idea, here's an official of the Congregation for Clergy saying, hey, we need to use penal law for the common good. And we shouldn't ever think that the use of penal law is merely about punishing the offender, but is instead like for the common flourishing of our community. And we need to have new and better standards about that. And I was like really, really edified. Like, yeah, here's the Congregation for Clergy saying something that we've been saying, and something which is true, and something which is, I think, an awareness of something people have deeper awareness of since 2018. And yet the praxis of the Roman Curia on matters of penal reform and stuff often only gets attention, and perhaps we should point our own our fingers at ourselves at this, on aberrations like Rupnik or whatever.
I would push back slightly and say one of the reasons why we tend to only get upset about aberrations in penal law, and we don't tend to praise the sort of smooth turning of the wheels of justice. It's very hard to get a hold of
jurisprudence
in cases to say,
yes,
look at all these instances where it's going great.
That is the problem.
I'd love it if we could.
More transparency. I actually think more transparency.
I would love to report good news stories of canonical penal trials going the right way. I would love that.
There's two things that more transparency would do with regard to penal cases in the church. One, it would incentivize bishops and curial officials to do better overall. And, you know, transparency always is a good sort of watchdog. But two, it would make clear how often curial officials and dicasteries do get it right that goes completely unknown and completely unseen. Like the Holy See's governing apparatuses are not doing themselves any favors by doing their work wholly and entirely in the dark.
Yeah. I suppose the real test is going to be, who does James Martin call when it comes out?
That's an interesting question, Ed. And that leads me to something, to an email we got. We got a very interesting email this week, and that was a great transition to something I thought we were going to talk about only in the bonus episode today. So well done. We got an interesting email today, or this week, from a reader, and I think a listener to the show, who wanted to know, why was it that Father Martin, when he did his blessing after the promulgation of fiducia supplicans, why wasn't he penalized, or how could he be penalized? Let me pull up the email. My question is about the status of Father James Martin. The New York Times article, which ran about him blessing a same-sex couple, was made it seem as if he was intentionally trying to mislead the public into believing the Holy See had approved the blessing of same-sex unions when it has not. And then had Father Martin committed a canonical crime. So what happened is, shortly after the promulgation of fiducius supplicans, the New York Times had a report about a blessing conducted by Father James Martin of a same-sex couple. And Martin said in that article several things which seemed to fly in the face of fiducius supplicans, especially after its subsequent sort of clarification from the DDF. Father Martin said that or one of the people who was blessed said, Father Martin called us up to ask if we wanted this blessing, which, as we know, is a sort of in a violation of fiducius supplicans guidance, which says that a blessing can be given to those who spontaneously request it. But in this case, it was offered. And then the thing was given a sort of public platform and public elevation by virtue of inviting a New York Times photographer there, which undermined, in addition to the request element of it, the spontaneity element of it. And then some people were of the opinion, and I think this one is a matter for a legitimate disagreement, that inviting a New York Times photographer there and speaking for this article and these kinds of things did more to give the appearance that the fiducius supplicant's blessing, which was not liturgical, which was given in a living room, Father Martin was invested, these kinds of things, but did give more to give the impression that there was an analogy to be had between the fiducius supplicant's blessing and marriage itself, or a nuptial blessing or something like that. And so this person, sort of pointing out all of that, wanted to know, is Father Martin likely to face any kind of canonical penalty for that? And that's an interesting question, I think, on a couple of fronts. There's probably two answers. Why don't you give the first to why Father Martin is, in our opinion, not likely to face a canonical penalty for that?
Well, the first thing is who would be, I suppose the two twin.
Who would penalize?
Who would be doing the penalizing, and what is the supposed infraction for which he would be penalized? You can do a wrong thing, it doesn't make it a crime. And speaking as with a sort of defense lawyer hat on, I would say that the immediate aftermath of the publication of fiducius supplicans would give pretty much anyone who wanted it an almost invincible defense of confusion and misunderstanding, because there was quite a lot of it about, so much so that Cardinal Fernandez sort of walked back on his, and I will not say any more on this matter. We will not offer any further guidance.
We will not offer any further clarification except for the five clarifications we're about to give.
Precisely. But also that I see there's no obvious canonical delict at play here. I mean, you could do lots of things in the church that are bad. You can do lots of things in the church that are harmful.
Which violate a liturgical rubric or something like that.
Which violate a liturgical rubric, but that doesn't constitute them therefore canonical crimes. I mean, you see this cropping up all the time I see it cropping up all the time in our inbox when they say, oh, why isn't Father so-and-so or this person or whoever else, being punished because what they did here is clearly sinful. It's like, well, okay, but the overlap of sin and crime in the church is not 100%. It's not
100%. It's not nothing.
It's an eclipse, JD, is what it is. Because you see, one partially but not entirely obscures but fits neatly in, so you get a sort of halo effect.
Once upon a time I was falling in love. Now I'm only falling apart. Sorry, proceed.
Okay. You have sin in the church and you have crime in the church, and all crimes are ipso facto sinful. Like, you commit a crime that is a sin. But not every sin is constituted a crime. It has to actually be enumerated as a crime in canon law, either universal or particular. So I'm not at all clear in for what crime Father Martin would be punished for doing this thing. I think what he did was very ill-advised. I think a lot of people pointed out why it was very ill-advised. I think it detracted from the sum total of human understanding of what the church teaches and sought to teach, including in and with fiducius supplicans. But I see no obvious canonical crime. More to the point, he's a priest of the Society of Jesus, and the local Jesuit provinces, I think at this point, probably got on their sort of messaging switchboard when you call them. Father Martin Press 5.
That's right.
Which a recorded message we played saying, we're not going to do anything about it. He's fine. Yeah. We're happy with Father James Martin. He can carry on. Thank you very much for calling. Goodbye. I don't see the Jesuit province stepping in here, and they've given no indication that they would want to. And I mean, I suppose you could make an argument that because he did this thing in the Archdiocese of New York, it would be proper to the Archbishop of New York to wade in and express an opinion or perhaps sort of thing if there was a canonical delict, which again, I don't think there was. But if there was, I suspect that the answer from the Cardinal Archbishop of Newark would be, why is everybody looking at daddy? You know, we're not going to...
Which is a quote, by the way.
Yes.
Not a summary, a quote of something that the Cardinal Archbishop of Newark said the last time someone complained about it. Something that happened in the diocese.
Yes. Debatable. Did it happen? You and I had a big fight about whether or not Governor Andrew Cuomo was under the ecclesiastical jurisdiction primarily of Cardinal Dolan of New York or Bishop Scharfenberger of Albany.
But at any rate, we did have that fight. It was an interesting one because the official residence of the governor is in the capital, et cetera. But when the question was raised to the point, that was when Cardinal Dolan said, you know, people were saying, why isn't Cuomo facing some ecclesiastical sanction, whatever that would be? And Dolan said, well, why is everybody looking at daddy? You guys are the voters. You vote him out if you don't like him. And that was his response.
Anyway, so I don't see either of the two ecclesiastical authorities who could perhaps claim some jurisdiction over Father Martin in this case having any incentive or inclination so to do. So that, in a nutshell, is my answer to the question from you, dear reader.
Yeah, and you gave all the answers, and I think you are right about that. So, reader, if you're wondering, would Father Martin face an ecclesiastical penalty for the perception of overreach on fiducia supplicant? It is our idea that he probably wouldn't. If you wanted to, if someone wanted to, whether it was the Archbishop of New York or the Jesuit provincial, Ed, you say not every sin is a crime and those kinds of things. That's true. But this seems to me like if a bishop or religious superior wanted to punish for this, they would be well within their rights to do so in accord with Canon 1399. Besides the cases prescribed in this or other laws, the external violation of divine or canon law can be punished with a just penalty only when the special gravity of this violation requires it and necessity demands that scandals be prevented or repaired. From my point of view, it seems to me that this is a necessity demands that scandals be prevented or repaired situation, if ever there was one, and there is an admitted deviation from the norms of fiducia supplicants with the way that that blessing came to be. So I don't think that anyone who wanted to, any conscientious superior who wanted to, couldn't use 1399 to impose a penalty.
The external violation of a divine or canon law can be punished by a just penalty in addition to the cases established here and other laws. What is the divine or canon law that has been violated?
What's fiducia supplicant? An instruction?
No. Oh, I think it's a declaration.
Okay. So this raises an interesting question. Is fiducia supplicans
law? No, it is certainly not law.
Fiducia supplicants. So this is what's very interesting. Fiducia supplicants delineates effectively a process for the conferral of a particular kind of blessing. But on what authority? It's not an instruction. So like an instruction could say, oh, this is an instruction on the blessings which could be conferred according to the, at least by implication, the Book of Blessings, right? Because an instruction clarifies the law. But this thing is meant as a sort of theological declaration, and yet it is very obvious that it and the subsequent clarifications which come from it are delineating a procedure. The person must approach spontaneously. There must be no danger of scandal in this way. The thing can't be drawn from the liturgical blessing, but can only be a sort of spontaneously conferred blessing. It's delineating a process.
Yeah, but those are all subsequent delineations that followed.
But do any of those things, does fiducia supplicans or any of the things, is it all theoretical until there's a process, until there's some legislation to follow it? I mean, it's possible that one could say, look, what fiducia supplicant says is very interesting, but I'm not sure I can do it until the church actually legislates about this instead of just
I don't know that you...
Because otherwise,
I don't think you need particular legislation. I think there is canon law that you could. I would certainly argue one could constitute a delict if you did what Father Martin did now, because Cardinal Fernandez has issued all of these somewhat exact clarifications and delineations and things that you say. But at the time that fiducia supplicans was first issued, these were all open questions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the declaration itself made a couple of sort of oblique. Well,
Couldn't be punished because at the time when he did the thing, there wasn't sufficient clarity that the thing he did wasn't the thing you're supposed to do.
I think he did some things that were clearly in bad faith in terms of, calling a reporter and, having a photographer there and all that sort of stuff. But no, I don't think it would be. I think anyone who stood accused by any ecclesiastical hierarch of having knowingly and willfully tried to, and I'm sort of thinking of legal language for, you know, canons that I know exist and laws that I know exist. So you could, you know, because again, you have to root this somehow in the extant law. You could say it was either willfully leading people into error or willfully violating or ignoring, you know, the wishes of a legitimate superior in the carrying out of an act or anything like that. I think anyone who wanted to advance a defense of ignorance or confusion would have an almost invincible defense in the immediate promulgation of fiducia supplicans, which I think Cardinal Fernandez recognized, which is why he had to, you know, make several rounds of clarification after its promulgation.
You are right. You are a born defense lawyer.
I spent too many years of my life watching good men, you know, succumb to the basic, the base prejudices and casual authoritarianism of men like you, J.D. Flynn.
Well, with that said, this week's episode of the Pillar Podcast was brought to you by the Seton Home Study School. Check it out at setonhome.org. And the Pillar Podcast is a production of Pillar Media and NGD Production. Our executive producers, Kate Oliveira. I'm your host, J.D. Flynn, an authoritarian jackboot tyrant if ever there was, and the people's champion Ed Condon is my co-host. We'll be back next week. Can you smell what Condon is cooking? Every now and then I get a little bit nervous that the best of all the years have gone by. Turn around. Every now